Growing businesses and finance professionals, you need Bill Spend and Expense, the free-to-use spend management software. It's powered by the Bill Divvy Corporate Card, which helps growing companies scale with credit lines of $500 to $15 million, automated expense reports, and as many virtual cards as you need. For a limited time, get $500 when you get started with Bill Spend and Expense. Request a demo at bill.com/get500. Terms and conditions apply. Advertised credit ranges are not guaranteed and are determined at approval. Card issued by Cross River Bank, member FDIC.
The sun had just gone down over the distant row of trees that reached for the faded yellow sky with branches that still looked like hands clawing their way out of the earth. It was late April around Chicago, and the leaves of spring hadn't yet grown in to filter the last minutes of sunlight from the old stone quarry next to where the Ford automobile was parked. Two men stood next to the car. Each of them had a shovel in his hands. In the distance, near the town of Oswego, Illinois, a train whistle blew. Aside from the calls of a few birds in the woods that surrounded the quarry, the end of the day was silent. The two men walked away from the car. They paused near some large stones, found a patch of dirt, and began to dig. They didn't have much to say, although they were friends. Both men had been shocked and saddened by the last few days. They only wanted to finish their job and get things over with. The next part of it, they knew, would be worse. Once the hole they were digging was completed, they returned to the house where the death had occurred. They helped load the body of their friend into the car, but only one of the occupants of the house returned to the quarry with them. They parked the Ford near the hole they dug at the quarry, and the three men lifted their friend's corpse from the back seat and carefully laid him inside of it. One of the men returned to the Ford and retrieved several cans that had been placed into a burlap bag. He handed the cans to the tallest of the three men, and he opened them up, placing them side by side at the edge of the hole. The tall man knelt down. Strands of his dark hair fell forward as he leaned over the dead man. His eyes were sad. The man in the grave had been his friend, one of his best friends, as a matter of fact. He'd always been there when needed and could be counted on at a pinch. He shook his head a little, frowned, and rubbed at the thin mustache he'd recently grown to change his face a little. And then the man, the infamous bank robber, John Dillinger, finally spoke, delivering the only eulogy that his pal was going to get. "Sorry, old friend, to have to do this. I know you'd do as much for me." And then he picked up the cans of lye that he'd taken from the car. He dumped out their corrosive contents over the face of the dead man, hoping that if the body was discovered, his features would be obliterated enough to throw pursuing lawmen off the trail. Or at least that's the official version of the story. The records say that John Red Hamilton was laid to rest in a shallow grave in that quarry, to rest in whatever peace he could find. But legends tell other tales. There are stories, rumors, tall tales, and whispers that tell very different stories about the fate of Red Hamilton. There's speculation about where he died, when he actually died, and whether his ghost, or at least the ghost of the man buried in that grave, still haunts a house where someone took his final breaths. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to Season 8, Home, which is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and produced and co-hosted by Cody Back. With all our episodes this season, we're taking you along for the ride as we go in search of America's murder houses, where the spirits of crimes gone by still linger. We're going behind the locked doors of both famous and little-known places where murder, violence, and bloody events continue to echo today as a haunting. In this episode, you'll be riding along with the Dillinger Gang in the spring of 1934 and tagging along for the last days of one of Dillinger's best pals, John Red Hamilton, whose life, death, and mysterious afterlife may be even more compelling than what happened to Dillinger himself. So make sure you've got plenty of bullets for your Tommy gun. You've dusted off your fedora, and be sure to pack plenty of bandages and painkillers as we hit the road for what'd be Red Hamilton's last hurrah. John Hamilton met the man who'd become one of his closest friends while at state prison in Michigan City, Indiana, when John Dillinger was transferred in from a reformatory for young offenders. Hamilton had been at Michigan City since March of 1927 and was already well-liked when Dillinger arrived. He'd had a couple of nicknames stemming from two missing fingers on his right hand, which, by the way, he'd lost as a boy after being dared to show how fast he could put his fingers through a train's speeding wheels. But most of his pals just called him Red, though, thanks to the color of his hair. Born in Ontario, Canada in 1898 to John and Sarah Hamilton, Red had eight brothers and sisters. When he was three, Hamilton's family moved to Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and he spent his boyhood in the region, attending McKinley Public School. He was also a faithful attendee at Sunday school and was a better-than-average student. He loved the outdoors and spent much of his time hunting and trapping. He was an excellent marksman who won several shooting competitions, a skill that would, of course, come in handy later in life. After leaving school in the 10th grade, Red works as a lumberjack and as a deckhand on a Great Lakes freighter. Around 1919, he joined two friends in Pontiac, Michigan, where the three worked as freight hustlers for the Oakland Motor Company. On August 22, 1921, he married Mary Stevenson, the woman that many claim would be his downfall. Mary's brother, Alva, was part of a criminal gang, and she had a taste for high living. During their marriage, the couple lived on a small farm where Mary had a garden and kept chickens. Red worked in the lumber camps and did a lot of bootlegging on the side. The couple had two sons, Howard and Orville. In 1923, Red skated out of town after a liquor still was discovered in his chicken coop, but he was a little too slow and was arrested. In 1924, he jumped bail and hooked up with Mary's brother for a series of robberies. But Red kept trying to go straight. Well, sort of. By 1926, he was working as a carpenter and living with Mary and the children in Detroit. He was also smuggling rum into the U.S. from Canada. After one arrest for which the charges were dropped and a few close calls, Red finally ran out of luck in March after one member of the Stevenson gang sold out Red and a few others to save himself from jail time. He told the police about the bank the gang planned to hit next, and Red was caught in South Bend, Indiana. He was sentenced to spend the next 25 years behind bars. And Mary didn't wait for him to get out. While he was locked up, she got a divorce and later married a man in Toledo, then died in childbirth in 1930. Red's two sons were sent to live with his mother-in-law in Ohio. While in prison, Red became friends with Dillinger and several other bank robbers and outlaws like Harry Pierpont, Homer Van Meter, Russell Clark, and Charles Mackley, the men who would become the core of the Dillinger gang. In May 1933, Dillinger was the first of the tight group of pals to be paroled, and when he was released, he vowed to break the others out of prison. Using a list that had been put together by Red and Harry Pierpont, Dillinger began robbing banks to finance the escape plan. Just 4 months later, he managed to get a barrel filled with guns smuggled into the penitentiary, and the armed men escaped right out of the front gates. And then hit a snag. Dillinger had been arrested and was being held in Lima, Ohio. Determined to free him, the escapees robbed the First National Bank in St. Mary's, Ohio, to finance the jailbreak and walked off with $14,000. 9 days later, they hit the jail and freed Dillinger, killing Sheriff Jess Sarber in the process, a mistake that Mackley and Pierpont would later pay for. Over the next few months, Red took part in several daring robberies with Dillinger and the rest of the gang. After another profitable robbery in Wisconsin, the gang went down to Florida for a time and then went west to Tucson for some rest and relaxation. But Red had business in Chicago. Fulfilling a promise he'd made to some other friends, he took part in a bank robbery on December 13, 1933. He left with his share of the cash, but then things went awry. Red planned to leave town in a car that he'd left at a local garage the day before the robbery. He needed a little body work to be done. For some reason, though, a mechanic at the garage had called the police and told the cops he suspected it was a gangster's car. Well, when Red returned to pick it up, Sergeant William Shanley and two other officers were waiting for him. Gunfire was exchanged and Red escaped, leaving two men wounded and Sergeant Shanley dead on the floor of the garage. Out west, Dillinger and the others had problems of their own. They were picked up in Tucson, and Dillinger was extradited to Indiana, where he faced murder charges for a bank robbery in Indiana that happened while he was in Florida. He was accused of killing a cop during the robbery. It's ironic, he'd been arrested and flown halfway across the country for the one robbery he probably didn't do. But it didn't matter. He didn't stay locked up in the county jail in Crown Point for long. Along with another prisoner, he slipped out the back door, stole the sheriff's personal car, and fled to Illinois, where he went to work putting together a new gang, which included Red Hamilton, Homer Van Meter, Tommy Carroll, Eddie Green, and the always volatile George Babyface Nelson. Red was along for the string of lucrative but chaotic robberies that followed, including one in Mason City, Iowa, where he was wounded. According to inside sources, the bank had over $240,000 in its vault, which would have made it one of their biggest scores. The gang drove up to the bank on March 13, 1934, and all of them went inside except for Nelson, who stayed with the car. Trouble began almost as soon as they walked through the doors. John Dillinger had once boasted to a newspaper reporter that he could rob a bank in 90 seconds. Flat. But he didn't mean this bank. When bank president Willis Bagley saw Homer Van Meter walk into the lobby carrying a machine gun, he thought there was a crazy man on the loose, or so he later said, ran into his office and bolted the door. Now Homer, knowing Bagley had the keys to the room where the vault was, opened fire on the door lock, hoping to break it open, but it wouldn't give. Watching the clock, he gave up and helped the rest of the gang clean out the teller drawers. A moment later, a guard in a special steel cage above the lobby fired a tear gas shell at Eddie Green. The heavy brass canister hit Eddie in the back and almost knocked him down. Eddie spun around to see where the shot had come from. He thought he'd been hit by a bullet at first, then spotted the guard and fired his Tommy gun. The cage had been designed for protection from bullets, but not quite that many bullets at once. They bounced off the metal and marble walls, and the guard was clipped several times. He went down, bleeding, but alive. And just then, a female customer, who was missing a shoe, slipped past the gang and ran out of the bank and into the arms of a short man wearing a cap on the sidewalk outside. She begged him to call for help. The bank was being robbed. But the short man was Babyface Nelson, who laughed and sent her back into the bank. Meanwhile, Red was having his own problem. Head cashier Harry Fisher had barricaded himself in the locked room with the vault. Red tried to get the door open, but the locks wouldn't budge. But with the clock ticking, he pushed open the slot in the door and trained the muzzle of his gun on Fisher. He then ordered him to start passing money to him through the opening. Fisher began handing him nothing but stacks of $1 bills. Well, by now, Dillinger knew their time was up, and he started moving some of the bank customers and employees out to the street to be used as hostages as they drove out of town. He pushed a group together and then shuffled them out to the street. Just then, a retired police officer named John Shipley spotted Dillinger from a third-floor office and took a shot at him. He winged Dillinger on the arm, who whirled around and returned fire. The bullets bounced off the front of the building, and Shipley ducked away unhurt. It was time to leave, Dillinger decided. He sent Homer back inside to get the others. Red was still having problems with the clever cashier. He could look through the door slot and see the stacks of cash on the shelves inside the vault, and he demanded that Fisher open the door. But Fisher said he couldn't, not without the key. All Red could do was keep threatening the man with his gun while Fisher continued to shove stacks of small bills through the door. Red lost his temper and was ready to shoot the cashier when Homer came inside and told him they were leaving. Red had only about $20,000 in his bag, even though he could see more than $200,000 just sitting there in that vault. Fisher was lucky Red didn't just shoot him out of spite before he left. I have to admit, I probably would have. And later on, Red said he wished he had. But now he could only clench his teeth in frustration and follow the others out of the bank, just in time to have Officer Shipley across the street return to his office window and start shooting again. A bullet struck Red in the shoulder, and he staggered for a moment, switched the money bag to his other hand, and joined Dillinger and the others. With 20 hostages on the running boards, fenders, and hood of the getaway car, the bandits climbed inside and they drove slowly away, with the car groaning and creaking from all the extra weight. Unable to shoot at him without hitting one of the hostages, the police were forced to follow them at a distance. Then a few miles out of town, Nelson climbed out of the car and opened fire in the direction of the cops who were still pursuing them at a snail's pace. This forced them to turn back. A short time later, the gang dropped off their reluctant passengers and headed for St. Paul with less than a quarter of the money they believed the robbery would have earned them. The gang didn't stick around St. Paul for long. After a close call with the cops, they scattered and went in different directions. We don't know where they all ended up, but we do know what happened to Dillinger and Red. Both men were tired and unhappy at this point. Dillinger's girlfriend, Billy Frechette, had been grabbed by agents from the Bureau of Investigation and was now out of his reach. His mood was sour, but Red's was even worse. With each passing day, he became more convinced he was going to die soon. Being shot during the last robbery hadn't made his premonition go away. On several occasions, he told Dillinger he wished he could see his sister in his hometown of Sault Ste. Marie just one last time. Well, Dillinger tried to talk him out of it, knowing the trip would be dangerous, but the more Red stewed about it, the more he wanted to go. Finally, with a sigh, Dillinger agreed to go with him. On Tuesday, April 17th, Dillinger left Chicago in a powerful V8 engine Ford, his favorite getaway vehicle. In fact, he loved those cars so much, he once wrote a fan letter to Henry Ford himself. Watching for speed traps, he followed Red's car into Indiana and then both turned north to Michigan. At nightfall, the two cars stopped for gas at a station outside Sault Ste. Marie. As the attendant filled his tank, Dillinger stood in the light rain with his hat pulled down low. It was the last place he wanted to be. "You're a long way from home," the attendant said to him, gesturing to his Minnesota license plate. "What line of business are you in?" "I'm a clothing salesman," Dillinger replied. He paid the man and left. It was dark when they drove into town. They arrived at the home of Red's sister, Anna Steve, at 8:30. They tapped on the back door outside the kitchen, and when Anna opened it, Red stepped out of the shadows, carrying a machine gun that was concealed under a blanket. Dillinger was right behind him. At the sight of her brother, who she hadn't seen in 7 years, Anna began to cry. Red held her and said they couldn't stay long. Wiping away her tears, Anna said she wanted to go out and buy some steaks to celebrate, but Dillinger shook his head and convinced her just to cook what she had in the house. Sending her three children upstairs, Anna put together a supper of bacon, eggs, and toast, and they ate at the kitchen table while the brother and sister reminisced about their childhood. When they were finished eating, both men shaved and Anna gave them quick haircuts. And for the first time in weeks, Red seemed happy. Around 10 p.m., though, the kitchen door opened, startling both men, who grabbed their guns off the table. But it was only Anna's 18-year-old son, Charles. Dillinger lowered his gun. "Charles, this is Johnny," Red introduced him. He didn't have to say anything else. The awestruck young man immediately recognized the family's visitor. Everyone went out to the sitting room where Charles watched the two men closely. His uncle seemed to have a hard time breathing thanks to his recent gunshot wound, and Dillinger was walking with a limp. He remained on edge, sitting near the window and saying little. He read the newspaper in between taking looks outside. Finally, around 11, Dillinger said it was time to leave. Red begged for one night to sleep at his sister's house, but Dillinger insisted it wasn't safe. He was sure the Bureau was aware of the place where Red Hamilton grew up, and they'd soon be on to them. As they gathered up their things, Anna started to cry. Red hugged her for a long moment and kissed her cheek. "Bye," he said. "I hope we see you again." According to most accounts, though, they didn't. The last time that Anna admitted to seeing her brother, he was walking down a muddy hill from her house. Red left his car behind in town for her as a gift. He got in with Dillinger and they drove away. Unfortunately, one of Anna's neighbors alerted the Bureau to the visit. Of course, by the time agents arrived the next day, they were gone. But Melvin Purvis, the head of the Bureau task force out of Chicago, who was supposed to get Dillinger, decided to send a message. Agents and local deputies raided the Steve home and led away Anna and her son Charles in handcuffs. There was no mercy for those who harbored criminals, the Bureau said. For Anna, the price for a supper of bacon and eggs, two haircuts, and 3 hours with her brother turned out to be 3 months in a federal women's prison. If the law couldn't catch and punish the criminals, they'd punish their families instead. The gang next met up in Fox River Grove, outside of Chicago, at a tavern called the Crystal Ballroom. Believe it or not, this was a terrible place to meet, although the gang didn't know it. An informant had told the Bureau the place was often used as a hideout for both the Dillinger and Barker gangs, but Melvin Purvis had just been too busy to put the place under surveillance. If he had, this story would be a lot shorter and a lot less bloody. But on April 19th, the gang gather at the tavern and all agreed they needed a spot to regroup, relax, and decide their next move in relative safety. A suggestion was made about a quiet resort outside Manitowish, Wisconsin, called Little Bohemia. It was a remote fishing camp that wouldn't get busy until May, so it was the perfect spot to hide out for a while. Over the next couple of days, the gang drove separate cars into the Wisconsin woods, and all of them ended up at Little Bohemia Lodge. They were supposed to lay low, but having a group of men, along with their girlfriends and wives, hanging out in a backwoods lodge wearing guns while they drank, ate, and played cards drew too much attention in 1934. Even as far away from civilization as the Little Bohemia Lodge was, or maybe because of that. Owner Emil Winnetka wondered to his brother-in-law if the guys were up to no good, and he wondered to someone else, and soon word of the gang's presence made it all the way back to Melvin Purvis in Chicago. Within hours, Purvis had dozens of agents on his way to Little Bohemia. The plan was to raid the lodge on April 22nd. On the night of the raid, Bureau agents arrived in three cars and, moving as silently as possible, approached the lodge. In the dim light of the porch, they could see four or five men talking. As Purvis watched, three of the men got into a Chevrolet coupe. His heart sank. Convinced members of the gang were getting away. They weren't. Agents were sent scurrying around to the back of the lodge to prevent more of the outlaws from escaping. Meanwhile, the getaway car was heading in the direction of Purvis and the other agents. They had no time to come up with a plan or even to think. They had to act. As the car moved toward them, Purvis and another man shouted, "Police, stop! Federal agents!" Other agents running wildly toward the car through the trees joined in the chorus, "Stop the car, federal agents!" The car surged forward. Two men appeared on the lodge's porch and began yelling, but with everything going on, no one could hear what they were saying. And the car didn't stop. As Purvis and the second agent ran forward, the car was coming right at them. "Fire!" both men shouted, and shots began to ring out from all over the clearing. Purvis's machine gun jammed, but another agent opened up on the car. His Tommy gun rattled and boomed, raking the car with slugs. Glass shattered, tires exploded, and the shadowy figures inside of the car danced wildly as bullets tore into them. Finally, the car sputtered to a stop. Well, hearing the gunfire outside, Dillinger, Homer, Tommy, and Red ran out the back of the lodge and disappeared into the woods along the lake. Nelson, who was staying in a separate cabin with his wife Helen, ran outside, fired some random shots at the agents, and then he also vanished into the trees. Purvis, though, believing the gang was still inside the lodge, ordered the Bureau agents to continue firing into the building. Windows were shattered, doors were filled with holes, and wood was splintered in the walls, floors, and ceiling. But there was no resistance from inside. After hours of waiting, they entered the building and captured only the wives and girlfriends of some of the gang members. They'd been hiding in the basement. As for the three gangsters who'd been shot at while escaping in the now bullet-ridden Chevrolet, well, they weren't gangsters at all. The Bureau agents had opened fire on three unarmed restaurant customers. The three men were John Hoffman, a gas station attendant, and two of his friends from the nearby Civilian Conservation Corps camp, John Morris and Eugene Bosino. The three men had just put on their coats and stepped out onto the porch when the bureau cars pulled up. The bartender and the busboy had followed them out to say goodbye. The three men got into Hoffman's car, and none of them saw the bureau cars in the dark driveway. Hoffman put the car into gear and started up the drive, still unable to see the agents, who began shouting for him to stop. The men in the car couldn't hear anything over the sound of the engine and the car's radio. They had no idea what was happening until bullets began slamming into the car and shattered the windshield. On the porch behind them, the bartender and busboy began shouting, "Stop! Stop! There are customers!" But no one heard them over the sound of the gunfire. Morris and Hoffman were wounded in the shootout, but Eugene Bosino was killed just for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. It was a disaster that would haunt the Bureau for years to come and make Melvin Purvis and Bureau head J. Edgar Hoover more determined than ever to get Dillinger once and for all. But that's a story for another time. For now, we need to catch up with Red Hamilton. While Bureau agents were filling Little Bohemia Lodge with lead, Dillinger and the other outlaws were stealing cars from neighboring farms and resorts and heading off in different directions. Tommy Carroll slipped away alone. Only Nelson ran into immediate trouble. He killed one federal agent, wounded another, and clipped a local officer before fleeing from a nearby resort. Dillinger, Red, and Homer stayed together, and in Park Falls, they snagged a Ford coupe and headed toward St. Paul. They didn't get far. At the Flambeau River Bridge near Ladysmith, Wisconsin, they ran into Russ County Sheriff Carl Nelson and his deputies, but managed to slip past them long enough to hit Wisconsin Route 46, cross the Mississippi River, and enter Minnesota at Red Wing. At 10:30 a.m., the three bandits approached a bridge over the Mississippi River at Hastings, about 25 miles below St. Paul. A policeman named Fred McCardle, along with three deputy sheriffs, were parked at the southern end of the bridge, checking license numbers against a bureau bulletin that had been sent out. As Dillinger approached the bridge, McCardle was startled to see the plates on the car matched a set on the list. He pulled out to give chase, but just as he did, a cattle truck cut him off. By the time that McCardle reached the other side of the bridge, Dillinger was gone. But McCardle wasn't going to give up easily. He and the three deputies continued northward towards St. Paul, hoping to catch up to the car. They had no radio, so there was no way to alert anyone that Dillinger was heading into the city. 10 miles north of the bridge, McCardle spotted the Ford. Deputy Norman Dieter leaned out the window with a .30-30 rifle and fired at the Ford's rear tires. He missed, and the Ford surged ahead of its pursuers. Dieter fired again, and this slug punched through the thin body of the automobile between the fender and the spare, tore through the rear seat, and drilled into Red Hamilton's back. He screamed in agony and slammed forward against the front seat of the car. Dillinger smashed out the window behind Red and returned fire with his .45, shattering the windshield of the police car just above Deputy Joe Heinen's head. For the next several minutes, the two cars engaged in a wild running gunfight at speeds of more than 80 miles per hour. The two cars traded shot after shot, but Homer, who was driving, managed to get ahead of the pursuing officer, spun to the right, and veered onto a dirt track called Cemetery Road. After losing sight of the car, Officer McCardle drove on past. By the time he realized the Ford was no longer in front of him, it was gone. Homer found a secluded spot and pulled over. Red was losing a lot of blood from the gaping wound in his back, and he needed a doctor. First, though, they would need a faster and less recognizable vehicle. The local cops were surely onto them by now. They cruised the back road south of the city for almost an hour, and then Homer managed to flag down a brand new Ford V8 Deluxe. It was driven by power company manager Roy Francis, and with him was his wife Sybil and their 19-month-old son. He'd seen Homer on the side of the road and pulled over to see if he needed help. Homer approached with a gun in his hand. He was almost apologetic. "I'm sorry to trouble you," he said, "but I've got to have your machine." Roy stepped out and began to raise his hands. "Keep your hands down. We're not going to shoot you," Homer said. Sybil, carrying the baby, got out of the car as the bandits tossed their belongings into the flashy roadster. Dillinger helped Red into the car next, gently easing his friend into the back seat. "What do you do?" Homer asked Roy. "I work at the power company." Homer smiled sadly. You're lucky to have a nice job and a family. Sybil Francis recognized Dillinger right away, but he smiled at her reassuringly and patted the baby on the head. He told her, "Don't worry about the kid. We like kids." The bandits wished them well and drove off in their Ford. The Francis family walked 2 miles to a service station and called for help. Red was in terrible pain, and while Dillinger feared he might not survive the trip to Chicago, St. Paul was now off limits. After the police chase, they would have cops and federal agents scouring the city for them. The best thing to do would be to find a safe place to hide out down south, where they could find a doctor for Red. They turned south towards Chicago with the dying man in the back seat. Eventually, the men made it to Chicago. Dillinger was desperate to find a doctor for Red. The wound in his back, which was the size of a silver dollar, was festering and starting to stink of gangrene. Blood was all over the inside of the car. They'd bought bandages and medicine in Dubuque, Iowa, but if Red was going to have any chance at all to live, he needed a doctor. They had a set of stolen plates on the car, but Dillinger knew he couldn't drive around Chicago for long with a bleeding man in the back seat before someone noticed. Dillinger was searching for the unscrupulous Dr. Joseph Moran, the greedy practitioner who was known for treating underworld characters. He was always willing to lend his services for a price, of course. But this time, Dillinger couldn't find him. So he went to the Hi-Ho Inn, a Cicero nightclub that was operated by brothers Bobby and Joey O'Brien, but they wanted nothing to do with him. Dillinger was too hot. They sent him away, but they did promise to try and find Dr. Moran and would rendezvous with him later that night. Dillinger's visit started a series of telephone calls. The O'Brien brothers called Elmer Farmer, who owned a safe house often used by the Barker gang. He called Doc Barker, who tried to reach Moran but couldn't. Meanwhile, Joey O'Brien drove to Aurora, Illinois, and picked up Volney Davis, who'd been living in a safe house there for a few weeks. Davis was a bank robber who often worked with the Barkers and Alvin Karpis. Everyone met up that night in a parking lot behind the Seafood Inn in Elmhurst. Red was moved from the Ford to the back of Volney Davis's Buick, and then Dillinger and Homer followed Davis back to Aurora and the safe house. The place was empty when they arrived. Davis had sent his girlfriend, Edna Rabbits Murray, to stay with friends. Red was carried inside and put to bed, but no one believed he could last for very long. His agony was increasing by the hour. Members of the two gangs tended to Red all that night and for 2 more days, doing their best to ease his pain. And he finally died on the afternoon of Thursday, April 26th. At dusk, Doc Barker and Volney Davis drove to that quarry near Oswego and dug a grave. He was laid to rest there later that night. Or was he? As it turns out, there are actually several different versions of what happened to Red Hamilton after the bungled raid at Little Bohemia. Now, one story goes like this. After Red was buried at the quarry, the men returned to the safe house, and it was such a mess that Davis said he called Edna Murray to come over and help him clean it up. He said she nearly fainted when she arrived. White disinfectant powder covered the bedroom floor. The sink was piled high with dishes and medicines and bloody bandages. The whole house stunk of rotting flesh and death, or that's what Volney Davis later claimed. Edna Murray had a different story. She'd been ordered out of the house before Red and Dillinger ever arrived there, and she later stated she didn't hear about Red's death or the burial until she reunited with Davis much later. She never saw the blood-soaked safe house or the mess left behind by Red's final days of suffering. The Bureau also knew nothing of his death. Despite the blood that was splashed all over the backseat of the car that Homer and Dillinger had abandoned, Red's death was considered uncertain. Reports of it were based on informant stories, which were second and third-hand accounts. No one who talked had actually been there to see Red die, and every one of them told a different version of the story. One rumor claimed he'd been buried in the sand dunes in northern Indiana. Another claimed he'd been weighted down and dropped into an abandoned mine shaft in Wisconsin. It wasn't until Volney Davis was arrested, escaped, and arrested again that Bureau agents learned of the unsuccessful efforts of Dillinger to get medical treatment for Red from Dr. Joseph Moran. Another version of the story had it that Dillinger tracked down another doctor. In late July 1934, Melvin Purvis was told that Red was being treated for a badly infected wound by Dr. Harold Cassidy. Not treated in the past, but being treated at that time. So if this was true, then Red was still alive several months after he allegedly died. There were others who also wondered about Red's demise, including Dillinger's attorney, Louis Paquette, and his investigator, Art O'Leary. If Dillinger truly had been desperate to find help for Red, he would have contacted them, but there's no indication they spoke to him in late April. Both men had proven they could be trusted, and yet Dillinger even repeatedly lied to them about what happened after Little Bohemia. He told them that he and Homer had hidden out in Wisconsin and later buried Red next to Lake Michigan. He never mentioned the Barkers, Davis, or anything else that allegedly occurred. So could he have been covering up the fact that Red didn't die? If only Davis, though, stuck to the story that Red had died in agony in Aurora, and he provided a general description of the burial site. There were inconsistencies of the actual time and place of Red's death and those involved in the burial, but more than a year later, on August 28, 1935, federal agents who went digging in an Oswego gravel pit found a badly decomposed body. But who was it? Red was supposed to be dead, but the Bureau had been receiving reports from police officers and civilians alike that claimed Red was alive and hiding out somewhere in Indiana. The body they found was so corroded with lye that there was little to use for identification, aside from some hair and the dead man's belt size. The best they could do was pull a few molars from the skull and send it to the physician at the Indiana State Prison. He compared them to Red's dental chart and declared the Bureau had found their man. This satisfied J. Edgar Hoover, who proclaimed the belated discovery of the last member of the Dillinger gang to every newspaper in the country. The case of John Hamilton was now officially closed. The body that was taken from the gravel pit was buried in the Oswego Cemetery after a funeral service that was paid for by Red's sister, Anna Steve. Well, rumors spread around Oswego, and some of them still linger today. According to some stories, Red didn't die in Aurora at all, but right there in Oswego. One story even pointed to a house in town where Dillinger and his gang allegedly holed up while Red slowly died in agony. Past owners of this house reported to me firsthand that the house was definitely haunted, and they believed the lingering spirit was that of John Hamilton. But what if Red wasn't dead at all? The Bureau, which eventually became the FBI, continued to receive reports that claimed Red was still alive. They arrived on a regular basis, but most were disregarded, written off as hoaxes or mistaken identities. But there was at least one that was pretty convincing. It arrived at FBI headquarters on August 24, 1936, a year after Red's body was supposedly found at the quarry. It was sent by a former prisoner who was identified only as Happy. The letter writer knew some of the gang members and is now believed to have been a Dillinger associate named Fred Myers, who lived in Chicago. The letter was addressed to J. Edgar Hoover and read, "Will you kindly advise how much you will guarantee in cash, secret, and confidential information about the movements of John Hamilton? There are three people who know that he is still living and happen to know the details concerning him. If interested, please make offer through personal column of Chicago Tribune as follows. HAP star will buy, comma, 000 bushels, meaning, of course, that many $1,000 for this information, and place the word Ed after the word bushels." The writer promised details about Red's current location and movements, but how seriously this was taken is unknown. There's nothing to indicate that Hoover himself ever saw the letter and no one followed up on it because the official word was that John Hamilton's body had been found. Hoover had won the National War on Crime. I mean, hey, Time magazine said so. And he didn't need some worn-out gangster turning up and muddying the waters. Was there any truth to the letter? There are a lot of people who believe there was. One of those who became convinced that Red survived his wounds and wasn't the man buried in Oswego was his own nephew, Bruce Hamilton. Many years after the fact, he described a trip that his father took to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan in 1945. When his father, Wilton, returned home, he suddenly paid off the mortgage on their home in South Bend, Indiana, and bought the family's first new car. Bruce was later convinced that the money came from one of the Dillinger gang stashes of loot, the location of which was known by the only surviving member of the gang, Red Hamilton. Less than a year later, Wilton took his family, which included his wife, daughter, son, and 15-year-old Bruce, to Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, for a family reunion at the home of his sister, Anna Steve. There were more than a dozen family members there, one of which was Bruce's uncle, a red-haired older man named John. Wilton told his kids they were never to discuss this trip with anyone. Around this time, Wilton and Red's brother Foy, who had recently been released from prison, also came into a great amount of money. He used it to build a machine shop in Rockford, Illinois, and he also purchased an island on the Great Lakes near Sault Ste. Marie. He bought two boats and a seaplane that were used to get to and from what he called his vacation island, where a large cabin was built. Bruce suspected that the cabin was where his uncle was living. Later, Bruce claimed that his father told him what really happened to Red after being wounded, fleeing from Little Bohemia. According to his father's story, the wounded man was first taken to a safe house in Aurora, but then was moved to Chicago, where he was treated by Dr. Cassidy. While he recuperated from his wound, he stayed with his brother Sylvester in East Gary, Indiana. With Red in safe hands, Dillinger hid with William Hamilton, Red's grandfather, in South Bend for a time and then spent the summer in Chicago. According to the FBI, Dillinger was killed on July 22nd at the Biograph Theater. But we've already discovered that their version of the truth can't always be trusted. But like I said earlier, that's a story for another time. By the time Red recovered from his wound, Dillinger and the rest of the gang were gone. Babyface Nelson was dead. Pretty Boy Floyd had been shot down in a field in Ohio, and the days of the 1930s outlaws were over. Red worked as an electrician in a family-owned bowling alley in South Bend until 1937, when he moved to Canada, where he could be closer to his sister Anna. The Hamiltons maintained that he didn't die in Aurora or Oswego, but at home in his bed from natural causes in 1974. So if Red didn't die in 1934, whose body did the FBI find in that gravel pit a year later? And did it belong to the same person whose ghost was not only reported in the house in Oswego, but also in the former hideout in Aurora? See, that house was supposedly haunted too. It's been gone for many years now, but stories claim that legitimate tenants who lived in the house after Volney Davis were often spooked by strange sounds. Doors opening and closing, water faucets running by themselves, and footsteps that paced the floors of the house at all hours of the night. They'd heard the rumors. They knew the house had once been a hideout for gangsters, but they had no idea Red Hamilton supposedly died there. All they knew was that they weren't surprised to hear that someone had died or been killed within its walls. None of the tenants stayed for very long. Who could have died there, then been buried in Oswego, so that his ghost might also linger at the house near the former quarry that's now been replaced by a golf course? One possibility is that the body belonged to Dr. Joseph Moran, the former Army Air Corps pilot whose addiction to alcohol led to his downfall and earned him a reputation as a mob doctor and abortionist. He lost his license and been sentenced to 10 years in prison in 1928 after a patient died on the table. But he was released after only serving two. He made himself valuable by learning plastic surgery skills and how to obliterate fingerprints, and was most closely associated with the Barker Gang, although other outlaws used him too. It was Moran who stitched up Red after a previous shootout, hitting Dillinger up for a cool $5,000 for his handiwork. Some claim that Dillinger found Moran, but he refused to treat Red, knowing his wound was fatal. Others say Moran was missing at the time because he was supposed to be laundering ransom money for the Barkers after a recent kidnapping. They couldn't find him to help Red either, though. When the doctor did turn up, he demanded a share of that ransom, saying that if he didn't get it, he'd reveal to the feds that he'd removed Doc Barker's fingerprints. The Barkers didn't take threats lightly, and soon after, Doc and his brother Fred killed Moran and dumped his body. Where else? In that quarry near Oswego. The FBI searched for Moran for months after he vanished and later officially declared he'd been killed and dumped in Lake Michigan. When they uncovered his body in the quarry, they assumed it was Red Hamilton, but maybe it wasn't. Maybe that decomposed corpse really was Dr. Moran instead. If so, could it be his spirit and not Red's who haunts the nearby home? The owners insist the presence is a man. They've heard his footsteps and his voice muttering words they can't quite make out. They've even seen him, standing quietly, then vanishing before their eyes. They assume it's Red, but maybe it isn't. And if this ghost is Dr. Moran, then who haunted the safe house in Aurora where Volney Davis was staying in 1934? What if it wasn't someone who died there, but whose spirit returned there anyway? Like Volney Davis himself. On February 6, 1935, Volney was arrested in St. Louis and put onto a charter flight to Chicago. When the plane stopped to refuel in Yorktown, Illinois, Davis joined two bureau agents drinking beer in a local bar. When one agent went to make a phone call, Davis smashed the other agent in the face with a beer mug, jumped out a window, and disappeared. Davis wasn't recaptured until June 1st in Chicago. Davis spent most of the rest of his life in federal prison, eventually ending up on Alcatraz, where he was reunited with old pals like Alvin Karpis and Doc Barker. Unlike most of the other outlaws of the era, though, he died in his sleep in 1979 at the age of 77 in Sonoma, California. He never returned to Aurora in life, but could he have returned after death? Or is the answer to these questions simpler than I've made it out to be? By suggesting Red Hamilton survived the wounds he received after Little Bohemia. Maybe things happened just like everyone said. He died in that safe house and was buried in a gravel pit, never being heard from again, except as a ghost that once haunted the place where he died and continues to haunt the place where his body was eventually found. I guess you'll have to decide what you believe to be the truth. For me, though, I guess I'll have to say that the mystery of Red Hamilton is one that hasn't yet been solved, at least to my satisfaction. There's more show to come, so enjoy these delightful messages from our sponsors. It's not topping out or anything.
Okay. I think you're good then.
Okay.
Sound good to me?
All right. Welcome back to American Hauntings, and thanks to all who've joined us for episode number 10 of our latest season. My name is Troy Taylor, and I'm the creator of American Hauntings, and I wrote and narrated the episode where you were forced to tolerate my fascination with 1930s bank robbers. And with me is my producer, sidekick, accomplice, partner in crime, and a good man to have at your back with a Tommy gun, convict number 921437, Cody Beck.
Troy, you know,
it's baseball thing this week.
Damn it. I was going to say, it's a big privilege to be here, you know, like young kid from Boston. Thanks, man. I would have your back with a Tommy gun or any kind of gun. Where'd you come up with the inmate number? Was that just off the top of your head?
I just made that up.
Okay.
Yeah, I got nothing for you on that. I just made it up. So
I didn't know if there's some weird numerology.
Nope.
Oh, man. Troy, great to talk to you again. Like I said earlier before we started recording, starting to feel the heat in the Midwest.
Yeah. Yes. Pretty warm.
Yeah.
I have to agree with you.
Which is a lot.
Yeah.
So rolling with that in all ways that I can. My camera's up high just because I'm scantily clad because it's hot. But we're doing what we can to.
It is a real treat, I got to say. So, you know.
Yeah, no, I got you. But Troy, we have this is the last hurrah before the biggest thing of the year.
Yeah, it is. It's just days away.
And, you know, I'm not going to try to get anybody to pre-register now because you ran out of time.
Yeah, come on.
Can't do that. But I mean, you could still show up at the door if you want to. But I figure that if you waited this long, you're probably not coming. But, you know, hey, it's OK. There's always next year because we just passed the record we set last year for our record attendance. So nice. This will officially be the biggest one yet. And you know, it's not even here. I'm already planning for next year. I mean that literally. I've already been talking with Lewis and Clark, not the Lewis and Clark, but folks at Lewis and Clark Community College.
Cause they're in California, right?
No, Lewis and Clark are dead. And I'd have to get a Ouija board out for that one. But, just to talk to the folks at where we're having the event, we are already talking about next year. So yeah, it's going to be
beautiful.
Cool. I put a plug in here for my new book. And now I'm just not even saying you can get it at the conference, but if you're coming to the conference, you can, you'll be able to get the first copies, but if not, it's going on sale Monday, June 24th. That is Without a Trace number 2. I thought about Without a Trace 200, but or TOO, but I thought, let's just put a 2 on it and let's leave it at that. Cause then what are you going to do after that? You know what I mean? If I, let's say I do
without a volume.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So it just gets weird after that. So anyway, I just put a number 2 on it, but anyway, it is available to order on Monday. This is the one, I know you guys have heard me say this before, but this is the one that you guys helped me out on when we were doing our last season of podcasts. I'm pretty sure that, most, if not all, of the stories that people sent me ended up in this edition of the book. So pretty sure. But if you didn't read the first one, you can get a special deal on them. It's like both books for like $32 or something. So it's a pretty good deal.
Did you include the story when I came back from summer camp and I was like, Mom, where's my hamster? And she's like, you never had a hamster. Like,
no, I did not include that. Though there is a special section about animals that go to live on the farm. No, there really isn't. But that's what happened to your hamster. So, yeah, I know.
Can't wait to see that farm.
Yeah. So anyway, rest of the month, though, or actually less rest of the summer is thinning out. So if there's anything you want to attend this summer, things are booking up early. I've got just a few spots left for the Night Behind the Museum event that I do, you know, my favorite stuff from the museum. I'm going to do a new one on June 28th. But I will tell you that I'm getting some things that are coming in that will not be maybe added into the presentation, but they'll be in the museum. But I may add them in because I had to add another one of these because this one's almost full too. So I got another one on August 16th. So if you're interested in this Night Behind the Museum thing, it is fun. I honestly do a lot of these dinner events and I enjoy all of them, even the St. Louis exorcism. I mean, I know I've done it 1,000 times, but I'd still enjoy it. In fact, I just did it last weekend and changed it up again because I'm always changing it around. This is probably my favorite one right now is this museum one. So
awesome. Cause everything you've curated and collected and
yeah, it's just fun. You know, it's fun to get to do this stuff. So in July and August, I've got Abraham Lincoln coming up evening, Wyatt Earp, Lizzie Borden, Gangs of Southern Illinois, one more St. Louis exorcism that's almost sold out. I've got a couple of tours also. I think in August, I've got a Great Rivers Haunting one that goes to Pier Marquette for the chicken. I've got a Ghost of the River Road at the end of the month, I believe, that, you know, starts and ends in Alton. And then we are starting a new tour. We're trying it out. And that's also going to be in I think that's late July. And it's our Mississippi Spirits tour. And it is not a dinner tour. It's a river road tour. And it's going to be a combination of everything. But we're going to spend an extended time at the Rubel Hotel. And everybody comes along, gets a free drink. So whether that be, a soda or, you know, like when we do our museum thing, everybody gets a bag of popcorn and a pop. But in this particular case, you can have, you know, soda or you can have cocktail beer, whatever you want. So anyway, that's going to be included. I believe that is July 26th, but you can check it out. Dinnerandspirits.com. That's where everything is. So, yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I did have a couple of shout outs I wanted to give to the people that have been recently supporting us on Patreon.
Oh yeah. 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 Because don't forget about that, guys, because I just did actually the 25th, we'll have kind of a special episode of this podcast, but we're also going to have a Patreon podcast too, in addition to the conference. So I did kind of a special episode for next time. So it's a little bit outside the box, but it's a little bit different. But we've got three full seasons. That's our alternative podcast that is every other week that we do here. So if you are a fan of the podcast, you can listen to this one and that one and get something every week. That show is a little different. We do we pick one story and it goes an entire season. And I don't have dates set or times or anything. I don't know how long it's going to be. It's just I roll with it and put together, you know, different episodes. So we've done H.H. Holmes and we've done the Moonlight Murder and we've done Bell Gunness. And so those are all episodes or seasons that are finished. And right now we're in the middle of one about Ed Gein. And the Texas Chainsaw Massacre kind of mixed together. So with that, the movie version of Ed Gein. So if you're interested in that, check it out. It is at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. And Cody has some new members.
Yeah. And again, if
supporters, members, I don't know.
Subscribers.
So there you go. That works too.
Okay, yes. Cool. So just want to give a quick shout out. Thank you.
Yeah, for be an athletic supporter. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
To Brian, Drew, Dawn, Jennifer, Michelle, Stacy, Vicky, and Stephanie. So thank you so much for supporting the show. And if you are one of the people that only likes the first part of the show and doesn't like the banter, that's a perfect thing for you. Cause
that's all it is.
It's just Troy doing the monologue stuff.
Well, of course they're not going to hear this anyway. So. Because they don't listen to this part of the show.
That's true.
Yeah. Oh, so you just wasted air. On that, so
I know. And it's hot over here.
Yeah. You got it. You don't put any more hot air.
I know. Oh, damn it. I set myself up for all those.
A little bit.
Okay. Before we get started, we do have a listener review.
Oh, okay.
That I wanted to read. This review comes to us from Elidai and is titled Great Listen. The message is, I love to listen to y'all. The history and the lore is always interesting. Unlike some other podcasts, you guys don't pepper every statement with foul language that literally would make me turn the show off. Thanks for your show.
Sometimes
we do. I guess maybe her limit, that their limit is higher.
Well, that could be if it's not every word, because we don't do every statement.
Yeah, but we
do occasionally.
But I like to hear that.
We do occasionally, you know.
Yeah, but I like to hear like, hey, it wasn't too much. Like, great. If it's not too much for you, then absolutely.
Well, yeah, because you just never know. Because I know we've had a couple of things.
The foul language.
Anyway, yeah, fun stuff. So, yeah, I agree. I know people skip the chit chat at the end, but it happens. So,
yeah. That's all right. Cool. Well, hey, are you ready to dive into this episode?
Yep, I am. If you're ready.
Absolutely. So I knew right off the bat this was going to be something near and dear to your heart. So I didn't know what I was rolling into. And then I see Dillinger's name pop up pretty quick.
Yeah, pretty quick. It's not a John Dillinger episode. It just has some. It's a John Dillinger sidekick episode, so to speak, you know. So, Red is, was a close pal of his from. His during the time he was in that fraternity at Michigan State. Oh, wait, that was Michigan State Penitentiary. Sorry. So it was one of his buddies that he kind of educated the younger Dillinger in the art of bank robbery. So mm-hmm.
So I did have a big question about this.
Sure.
Do you think. OK, so I got two different things here. So do you think that possibly Dillinger could have done something other than, the kind of straight up story you told before you went on the, other routes? Do you think Dillinger would have done something out of respect or love for any of this thing? Or do you think he only would have done something like that if it would have benefited him? I don't really know. Did he have people he actually cared about?
Oh, yeah. No. He wasn't. I think everybody's got a good, not everybody, but, most people have a good and a bad side, especially somebody that becomes as famous as he did. I mean, if he had just been a complete and utter sociopath, I don't think he would have become the anti-hero that he, became. I think that this whole thing, kind of sets a prelude. As I mentioned earlier, there's a whole other story about Dillinger and Red Hamilton here, kind of disappearing, and Dillinger lying about it. But we do know that he really tried his best to find a doctor to treat him. Mm-hmm. He went out of his way. It wasn't a case. I mean, if he'd wanted to get rid of him, he would have dumped him on the side of the road somewhere, because they really didn't. He and Homer really didn't think he'd survive. But yep. These guys were pretty good friends. They had become pretty tight when they were all in prison together. Dillinger busted these guys out of prison. It wasn't just so he could start a bank robbery gang. He could have done that on his own. He had all the knowledge he needed. Now he could have found a few guys, because later he did, when he lost a few of the guys that had been with him in the beginning, because a couple of them got caught after. And again, I didn't get into all that detail because we were trying to focus on Red, but a couple of these guys, Pierpont and Mackley, those guys got nailed for killing Jess Sarber at that jail in Ohio. So he had to put another gang together, and he had to do it again after he left. You know, those guys all got caught when they were in Arizona. Dillinger got out and was able to hook back up with Red. But he had to, you know, get some of these guys, a couple of guys, and then get some new guys together, which is how he ended up with, you know, Babyface Nelson, which is that's a whole other story. I mean, that is a whole other story, but,
sure.
But yeah, so, I mean, I think that he really was friends with some of these guys and really went out of his way to do what he could for him, and, you know, going out and trying to find these doctors and finding a place. I mean, he made a lot of calls, called on a lot of people who told him to get lost because he was really hot at the moment. Those guys weren't getting anything out of it. Two guys, the brothers that ran the club. I mean, they were just trying to help out a guy who'd helped them out before.
Sure.
So I think there was a camaraderie. You know, they always say there's no honor among thieves. And I'm not sure that's completely true, depending on the situation. But in this case, these guys were trying to, trying to help out somebody that they cared about. So.
Fair enough. So we talked about Dillinger smuggling a barrel full of guns into prison, and then later they, which is awesome, but later they free Dillinger too.
They break him out. Yeah.
So I would imagine Dillinger's probably running the whole thing, but who's the next smartest guy in line that's helping along on either side of these things, you know?
The more reliable of the guys, Red Hamilton was one of the guys who really, he was a little older than Dillinger was by about 10 years or so. So he was kind of an older brother figure to him, I think. Mm. And while it was still John Dillinger's gang, I think that was force of personality. You know, I think Red was a lot more laid back, but he had all the knowledge. But he was definitely somebody that Dillinger counted on. Homer Van Meter was the same way. It was somebody he knew he could count on. Some of these other guys, you know, were just kind of bouncing in and out of their orbit. You know, I mean, these were the guys who were left that, you know, from the original core gang that he knew that he could count on. When you get up to Little Bohemia, and you're talking about guys, you know, Eddie Green and stuff, guys he didn't know quite as well as he knew the others, but, you know, still could count on him. But you'll notice who he escaped with.
Yeah.
The two guys who'd been with him the longest. You know, I mean, he probably would he have had Nelson jump along in the car with him, probably, even though they didn't like each other, and Homer and Nelson hated each other. Mm. But Dillinger wasn't real fun. He thought he was a loose cannon. But would he have let him come along? Sure. But he was staying in a cabin with his wife out back, so they were separated anyway. Everybody got away, but these three got away together. And I think that kind of speaks volumes to what happened.
Fair enough. So I'm curious about Dillinger's popularity and everything. Did any of this kind of stuff change once they started killing police officers and officials, or was that already happening while he was getting famous? Like, what are public opinion?
There was only one cop that Dillinger allegedly killed, and that was the one in Indiana that he was brought back to Crown Point to stand trial for. But the thing is, that robbery took place there. Again, there's a lot to that story. It's very complicated. This cop that got killed was running around with a dirty cop named Martin Zarkovich, who Dillinger knew. So there was a lot going on there. But Dillinger got blamed for this robbery. And he was in Florida at the time it happened.
Yeah.
So that's probably one that he actually didn't do that he was being blamed for. But you got to remember, though, that it's a lot like, you know, up in the Chicago area, everybody wants to tell you a story about how Al Capone used to come here. Al Capone used to hang out here. He didn't, because he wouldn't have had time to run a gigantic criminal organization if he was hanging around in all those bars and roadhouses and things he was supposed to be in, right? Sure. But the thing is that when you talk about gangsters, people automatically go to the most famous ones. So when you say, oh, you know, this was a gangster spot, oh, it must have been Al Capone, because that's somebody everybody's heard of. Well, back in the 30s, it was Bonnie and Clyde. You know, how many places, I mean, I couldn't even give you a list of how many places they were supposed to rob. They probably didn't. And Dillinger was right on top of it. Every time you hear a story from some old timer who remembers about how his dad told him that, you know, this guy used to stop and buy him soda pop and give him a nickel. Oh, it was John Dillinger. Probably not. But it was some gangster, most likely, yeah. But it probably wasn't Dillinger. And but so he gets blamed for everything, you know, and the same thing happened with a lot of these guys. Pretty Boy Floyd got blamed for the Kansas City massacre. Wasn't even close to Kansas City at the time. And yet he had a big name. And his name fit. And he was usually in that area, in that time, that side of Missouri or in Oklahoma. And so he got blamed for it. And so that happened a lot. And so this was really no different than that. How did it affect his popularity? Not very much, because people were, by, you know, 1933 and 34, were a little sick of the banks. And we've talked about this before. They were tired of the banks and the cop and the government agents and everybody who kept them from drinking for 13 years during Prohibition. And now the, you know, depression is underway and they're a little tired of losing their homes and their farms and not having any money. And they're blaming it all on the government. So anybody who's getting one over on them, hey, more power to them. You know, people would, you know, would cheer. I mean, you know, when he broke out of, say, for instance, Crown Point, I mean, that was completely bloodless. He didn't kill anybody breaking out of there. And people cheered him on, you know, because why not?
Yeah.
You know, what did it hurt? Usually, you know, there were a lot of stories that got started, some true, some fantasy, you know, stories about Dillinger going in and robbing a bank and, you know, getting ready to leave. And the farmer standing at the window tries to hand him his money. And Dillinger said, is that your money or the bank's?
Right.
He says, it's mine. He goes, I don't want your money. I just want the bank's. That actually happened. But it sounds almost too good to be true. And there's probably 50 other stories that aren't true that are along the same lines.
Got it. Okay.
And you got to stop me. You have to stop me when we're talking about these 30s bank robbers, because I will go on all day, as you know. So,
right. No. Okay. So I do want to move on. I want to talk real quick about the Mason City, Iowa robbery. They have all these hostages hanging on the car as they're
was a normal thing that they did.
No shit.
Yeah. It wasn't necessarily to put the, you know, to put the hostages in danger. It's just they knew the cops wouldn't shoot at them.
How would you feel if you were hanging on that car, though? Would you be like, oh, this is
I don't know. Fine. Well, I'd sure as hell have a story to go home and tell my, you know, for the rest of my life. I can tell you that.
Fair enough.
But yeah, I know what you're saying, though. And
I get what you're saying, too.
Yeah, it was, you know, they just pile a bunch, or they'd grab a handful of people and put them in the car because they knew the cops wouldn't shoot at the car as long as they had all those hostages along with it. And so it worked. And that's usually how they got out of these situations without shooting or killing anybody. You know, that's exactly how it was done. There were a couple of robberies that they did after Dillinger broke out of Crown Point that probably not a single bullet would have been fired if it wasn't for Babyface Nelson being a nutcase.
Little baby.
You know, but in this particular case, everything that could go wrong went wrong in that robbery. I mean, everything went wrong.
Right.
You know, but. And I don't know how Red didn't shoot that. I'd have shot that guy.
That's what I'm
just for the hell of it. Mm-hmm. As I was getting ready to leave and he'd handed me one more stack of $1 bills, I think I'd have let him have it. I'm sorry, but I probably would have. I think I'd have lost my patience by then. But
I am glad that they started training people like, don't fuck with robbers. Like, don't. Don't worry about the money.
It's all insured. You know, how much of it was insured back then, though? Probably not much. I'm not sure when the FDIC came along that would, you know, insure banks with their money. I don't know when that happened. I would say probably around the same time that gangsters were robbing the banks. I would think that might have been around that same time, you know, part of the New Deal.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. I don't know. But and I didn't look it up. And so
I think even at that time, even at that time, though, I think I would have been like, you know, it's not worth the prank. It's not worth my life. just take your shit. But I get what they were doing. But when you talk about them, you know, engaging in a gunfight at 80 miles an hour, eventually stealing a car or a truck from a couple with a baby.
Oh, yeah. Well, but they didn't hurt the baby.
Yeah.
And Homer, they were very nice. Well, you know,
I'm sure it was really nice.
They had to do something because, I mean, they needed to get somewhere because, you know, Red had been shot in the back and, you know, had a hole the size of a silver dollar in his back, and they needed to do something about it. And they needed a different car.
I understand.
The car they had stolen was a piece of crap. And this guy is driving this brand new, you know, Ford V8 Deluxe, which, you know, was the exact kind of car that Dillinger always wanted.
Right.
You know, and yeah, I know it's too bad about the family, but you know what? They were really nice to him, and, you know, they didn't hurt anybody. They got in the car and they drove away. Why am I making excuses for this? I don't know. Anyway, they got another car. Shut up.
Gosh. Okay. Okay. So we'll talk about Red dying then, or maybe not,
because that's where things get a little cloudy with the story.
Why is it
we know how he ended up at the house. We know all this. We know that, you know, where they went looking for help. We know that Dillinger went looking for doctors. We know the O'Brien brothers found a place for him to go, and they hooked him up with Volney Davis, who was a buddy of the Barker gang. And the Barkers had gotten to know Dillinger a little bit here and there, so they kind of all ran in the same circles. So we know he ended up at the house. We don't know what happened with Edna. You know, there's a difference of story as to whether or not she was there, if she came back to help clean up. All we know is that the guys were there. Volney Davis was there, and they went out and they dug a grave. He and Doc Barker went out and dug a grave, and that's where they put Red. They offer zero details about Red's last days and hours, only that they cared for him and that his wound had turned gangrenous. Mm-hmm. That's all they say. There are no details about any of that. In fact, the only details you'll ever find about that is a short story by Stephen King. He wrote a short story about the last days of Red Hamilton.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And that's just a fictional story.
Yeah.
Because we don't know what happened. You know, we know that a body was put in that grave. That story that I told at the very beginning about the things Dillinger said, that's part of the story that was told by Volney Davis after he got caught later on. But he probably, if he did know, he never told if that was really Red or if it wasn't Red. But we don't know who ended up in that grave, because there's no way to prove any of it.
Yeah.
You know, there are some possibilities as to who it was, which kind of makes sense if you believe the stories told about Red that were told later on about his family and about the money,
right?
Yeah, and all that stuff. And, you know, some of that stuff, I mean, as far as where that money came from, you know, that stuff's documented. We know this guy paid off his house and bought a car. We know that his brother, who'd just gotten out of prison, opened his own machine shop and bought a damn island.
Yeah. What the hell?
So we know that some money came from somewhere to a family who'd never really had that kind of money before and were, you know, direct relatives of John Hamilton. So I don't know. I mean, it's not hard evidence, but it's
circumstantial
for sure.
You know? Absolutely.
I like to think he got away because know how I am about the Dillinger thing. Of course, there is hard evidence with Dillinger, but again,
I got to stop you.
Whole other story.
You mentioned one story was convincing about a letter to J. Edgar Hoover. But something you mentioned in there, you said the war on crime. Was that a thing like the war on drugs, or did you just mention?
No. It was the war. They called it the war on crime. It started in 1933 and it ran through the end of Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, knocking off his public enemy number one list. Dillinger was the first FBI public enemy number one, you know, and then each time, you know, first it had been Bonnie and Clyde, you know, then it was Dillinger, then it was Babyface Nelson, then it was Pretty Boy Floyd, then it was the Barkers. And so each time, you know, Alvin Karpis would come in as number one, and they just, and, you know, eventually he was captured, you know, and he was one of the few who, I think we talked about him, who, you know, died in his sleep in a very ripe old age,
of course,
living in Italy, writing books and, you know, banging young women, you know. So
there you go.
I mean, this was a guy who, you know, really anyway, so, but yeah, it was FDR and Hoover put together this big publicity campaign of the war on crime to get rid of the public enemies. And
got
so
it.
You don't want, it's the same way with, you know, all the things that have come out since then about Dillinger, you know, and John Hamilton. You don't, it's over now. And we're not going to get that started again. And so, you know, Hoover didn't want any bad publicity. So they were just going to ignore it. Mm-hmm. You know, they would ignore these rumors. He wasn't doing anything. Well, it's kind of like the, you know, the Dillinger rumors. As long as he wasn't making any waves, they were going to keep their mouth shut. They were just going to deny everything and move on. And I think that even if, you know, let's just say it is, you know, Red Hamilton did survive, and it was Dr. Moran in that grave, which is a strong possibility, who did disappear at exactly the same time. Mm-hmm. Again, circumstantial evidence, but still fairly strong.
Right.
But, you know, and then, you know, you had all these other things. I mean, can you believe his family? Well, I don't know. Well, why sure. not? You know, but who knows?
But,
you know,
but
it's hard to say.
But it is, regardless of who was in that grave, there are still some ghost stories about
places
around
from
there.
The house where, you know, the house that they became a rental property after, you know, mm-hmm. it stopped being a safe house. People that, you know, just assumed, you know, it was a gangster because people knew the reputation,
right?
So and it certainly could have been. It doesn't necessarily have to have been John Hamilton. But somebody haunted the house. Nobody ever got an ID.
Dang.
And I had actually found out about the house near the gravel pit, which is now a golf course, by the way.
Right.
I had found out about that house. Gosh, that would have been like early 2000s. I had people who came to me and were telling me the story about their house being haunted. And then they had told me that they'd started doing some research, and that's how they found out that it was, you know, right where they had buried what everyone, again, these other stories hadn't come out, you know, quite that yet. I mean, they were around, but these people were just, you know, not historians. They weren't digging into gangster research. They had just known that that was supposed to have been where they found the body of John Hamilton. So they assumed it was his ghost that haunted the house. Again, they made that assumption because, you know, that's what the story said. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, they had plenty of ongoing experiences in that house.
Wow.
They later moved to the North Carolina, so they're not there anymore. I don't know who lives there now and whether or not the haunting continued or how long, I don't know. But yeah, there were definitely still ghost stories, two different ones this time.
Mm. Yeah. Man. Well, you know, I hope if he was haunting it that, you know, he had his best suit on with no holes in it or whatever they use when they rob banks, fedoras and all that.
Right.
Well, that's all I had about it, man. Is there anything else you want to touch on? I mean, I know you want to go into Dillinger stuff, but I know.
I'm not. So yeah, it was very tough for me to just skirt the edges of Dillinger.
You did a good job.
I tried to keep it all just kind of highlights of Red Hamilton instead of, you know, getting in the weeds there. So it's
you did a good job. It's nice to hear a story about kind of a sidekick instead of like the main guy.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of fun because it's somebody that you don't hear about much,
right?
You know, you really don't hear about the other guys very often. You know, it's sure it's Al Capone, but you know, what about Frank Nitti or what about, you know, or whoever, you know? So yeah, it was kind of fun. So to get to do it that way.
Awesome. Well, you know, it is now time for our Ghostwriter segment. And if you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com.
This message comes to us from Lori, and Lori writes, I just had to share with you guys that I was around when the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was in theaters, and I refused to go see it. After listening to the podcast, you twerked my curiosity, and I watched it this morning instead of working. I have to admit, I'm glad I watched it and only did so because of the synopsis you gave on the Patreon podcast. Way to go, guys. Good job.
Yeah, I've been turning from a lot of people that have been watching it who hadn't seen it before, and now, and they felt compelled, which you kind of have to. I mean, I feel like, and I think I said that maybe early in one of the earlier episodes of it, I was kind of like, okay, guys, if you haven't seen this yet, you really need to go watch it. And, you know, we're at least watch it up to the point where we're at, because I've been kind of walking through the synopsis with ongoing episodes, you know, as far as what's happening now and then what happened behind the scenes while they were making this part, you know. And so even if you watched it in pieces, it'd be kind of fun, actually. Just watch it up to the where we stopped, and now you can catch back up after the next episode, you know. So it might be kind of fun to do that for people who are
interesting
listening.
Yes,
yeah, it has been fun.
So awesome. Well, thank you for that message, and yeah, that's all I got, Troy.
Okay, well, I have some text messages.
What do you
we often do? If you have a question or comment you want to send us through text, you can text us on the Haunt Line, which is at 217-791-7859, and you might get read on the show. Other times, I will just answer you back occasionally if it's not something that I can translate into the show. Did get a text from Bob who wondered, thought perhaps I was being held hostage because I had, when I posted the last episode of the Patreon podcast, I put the wrong name for it. So I don't know what I was doing. I called it deranged instead of depraved.
I saw
that. Yeah. And then I changed it. It has been edited now, but Bob caught it. And I also kind of put in crazy letters, and he thought it looked like it was being clipped out of a hostage thing.
I thought you did that on purpose.
I did. That part I did. Okay. The name I did not. But Bob caught it. And anyway, we've already exchanged messages about that.
Yeah.
So
thanks, Bob. Ruined my plans.
Exactly. So, all right. So this one was from last time, and I put it off because somebody asked me a question, and I hadn't had time to look at it yet.
Yeah.
Now I got it. And once I looked to see what it was, I'm like, oh yeah, I absolutely know this. There just turns out to be like four different names for this particular story. And this came from Morticia in the 757. And she asked, are you familiar with an unsolved crime labeled the creepy murder in room 1046? Has so many odd twists and turns. Sounds like it would be right up your alley. That is also known as the unsolved murder of Ronald T. Owen. It's got like five different names, but it happened in January. And so every January I put up a post about it on my Facebook page. So yes, I am familiar with the story, and it is a weird one. And so if you guys check it out, look it up, you'll see what I'm talking about. And it's out there. It is out there. But yeah, I always do try to put a post up about it because it is really interesting. So so this one comes to us from Colby in the 217. And she writes, hey, guys, I just finished this week's episode. I've been planning a trip to Alton for my birthday to check out the museum. And then I heard you mention the Behind the Museum event coming up. So great timing. I've done multiple tours and event with Troy for over the past 20-ish years, and that is true.
Nice.
I know who this is, so it is true. And said it's always a good time, and said then I will see you soon. So yeah, and they are signed up for the end of the month,
beautiful,
the end of June. So yeah, it was kind of fun to get that. So like I said, it was a name I immediately recognized. This one's also from the 217, and this one comes to us. I don't know, don't have a name, just the 217. Mm-hmm. As I say, good morning. Listening to the end of Horror in Good Heart, thinking about oddities. Have you been to the House on the Rock in Wisconsin? Not really the same as your stuff, but wow, is it odd? And yes, it is very odd. It is worth the stop.
What's it about?
If you just like weird stuff, this crazy guy built this house literally up on top of this rock, and it's filled with all kinds of crazy stuff that he collected. And there's like a carousel in there and all kinds of nutty stuff. It kind of reminds me of like, Lookout Mountain down in Chattanooga. It's
okay.
You know, when you walk through there, it's just an odd place. It's so weird that in the book American Gods, that Neil Gaiman book,
yeah, absolutely,
that's the place where all of the gods meet. They find this bizarre place to meet, and it's House on the Rock.
Okay,
and it's like a media. Yeah, so it's just a. It is an odd place. It really is. And it also added, Cody just made me chuckle, Without a Trace 2, Electric Boogaloo.
Yes. So
I did not use that title. I've actually had that suggested to me a couple of times now.
Wow.
After you, other people have said the same thing. I did not go with that. So
you're lost.
I know. All right. So last one, this one comes from the 573, which I know is in Missouri. This was just quite the coincidence. I started the Depraved series on Patreon today, listening as I walked through thrift and antique stores in St. Charles, and I came across this gem as episode 2 was going. Wasn't what I was looking for, but had to snatch it up. Love the podcast and all the other things. What they picked up was a first edition, first printing of the 1994 Haunted Decatur, the very first book I ever did. The one I always laugh that says it. Wow. I literally like cut and pasted pictures and drawings and stuff in it, because that's how it was done, all offset print at the time. And so they've only paid $15 for it. I'm going to say that's $14.95 too much, but I've seen it listed at stupid prices and I don't understand why. But no one else can see this, that I'm showing this to anyone, but I'm showing it to you because I want you to see my mustache in the picture. Oh, you can't see it, can you?
No, it's a little too bright.
Yeah, it is too bright.
Mm. Maybe tap your phone for the light to never mind. I can see it later.
Yeah, all I'm getting is like a live thing. Anyway, I just want to just see my mustache.
You said really, I want to see really your mustache too.
Bad. It's actually it's about the same as yours.
Don't even.
I couldn't really grow one very well yet. I hadn't okay. become a all man. Right. Okay. So I ended up with a mustache that looks like
when yours. Am I going to get big and strong?
Yeah.
You said that first edition was 1994.
Yeah.
I wasn't even born yet.
I know. Well, I've been doing this for tragically a very long time. So
no, it's crazy.
Yeah, tours even longer than writing books. But yeah, that was the very first one. I've got one on display in the museum, just as an antiquity.
An antique, yeah.
Because it is definitely old. And yeah, those were the days. You really had to cut and paste and you know, and I hand drew.
Yeah, were the pages like sewn together?
No. I think it was glue still. But it was probably glue directly made from horses back then. Right. But yeah, it was been a long time ago. So, but you know, I weren't even sure anybody would buy it, and you know, sold 55,000 copies. So
Can't
complain too much for a book that looked like it was made in someone's garage, because it pretty much was.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was fun. So anyway, all right. So text messages, guys, if you're interested, be it on the haunt line, text us at 217-791-7859. And I guess we'll close this thing out. Are you ready? All right. Thanks for listening. Share the show with your friends, neighbors, anyone you know. If you like the show, or even if you don't like the show, leave us a 5-star review on iTunes anyway, or be a dummy and leave us a 1-star review, and just does the same amount of good. So anyway, send us an email or drop us a text on the haunt line at 217-791-7859. You can also check us out on our social media. You can find Cody and I on Facebook, Instagram, and occasionally Twitter, which I refuse to call X. Also, don't forget, use the discount code podcast when shopping for books, tours, events, or whatever at AmericanHauntings.net. You'll also find the link there for Cody's shirt store, American Hauntings Clothing. You can use the same code there too and get 10% off everything you order. And
beautiful.
Over to you.
All right. Well, this episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and performed by Troy Taylor, and it was produced and edited by me.
Wait, that's me.
Cody Beck. That's you.
Then Cody Beck, that's you.
That's me. I know. Wow, it's okay. Like we wrote this.
Awesome. Yeah, I know. Why? Right?
To find out more about the show, check out our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com, which features show notes, links, sometimes photographs that go along with each episode.
I should probably take that off there until we figure that out. But yeah.
Well, hey, you know what? Regardless, thanks again for listening. We couldn't, definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, which I hope,
I hope is at the conference.
But until next time, goodbyes.
So long. I jumped the gun. See you later.
No, I set you up for failure. Oh, man. All right.
So did you see that we have a...